Welcome to a Tuesday here on Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We have a packed show today. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we'll have our weekly segment, Our Living Lands, and we'll check in with the North Dakota Legislature with our weekly podcast, In Session, and we'll have a report from Harvest Public Media about U.S. farmers and how a renewed trade war with China might impact their summer. But we lead off Main Street today with our good friend, Alicia Underly Nelson, who just returned from a trip in Europe. Alicia, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our goal today is to talk about summer travel from North Dakota as a point of departure, either in the region or maybe even back to Europe. We'll see where our conversation leads us. But I'm curious, Alicia, what are you thinking about when you look at your summer and you're looking at regional opportunities that might be very popular for us in North Dakota and within driving distance?
Oh, there's so many great options. I think summer travel is a really great time to kind of get out of your comfort zone, try something a little bit new. But even with that said, there are still lots of people who maybe are new to the area or even who grew up here that haven't tried some of the tried and true local favorites. So I'm based here in West Fargo. So for me, it's a really simple drive to drive anywhere in Minnesota Lakes country. That is a wonderful place. I think everything in the summer, we kind of want to cool off, right? We want low effort travel. We want a nice, cool experience, maybe some swimming, maybe some strolling. We want the experience to be a little arranged for us. Maybe we don't want to work too hard to find a place to eat or some places to window shop. So anywhere in Minnesota Lakes country is great. I'm a big fan of Detroit Lake, but you can go to Brainerd. You can head out to Fergus Falls and experience more of a little small town break. You can go to Walker. I mean, there's so many options. Park Rapids is especially beautiful. And those are all like lots of mom and pop restaurants, lots of very pretty drives, lots of lodging options from camping and cabins all the way up to more luxurious kind of resort style places to stay. And then an underrated option that I don't think we think about here in, you know, the eastern part of North Dakota, but people in the central and western part definitely think about, is the Missouri River. That is a wonderful river to get out and about on. I have cousins in Bismarck and friends in Bismarck Mandan, and they are always out. You can rent boats. They're out exploring. People are hanging out, being on the water, dining by the water. And I also have had some great Missouri River experiences in Chamberlain, South Dakota as well. So if fishing and boating or kayak and canoeing is up your alley, you really can't beat the Missouri. And I'm a little bit jealous. You know, I grew up along the Red here in the eastern part of the state, and oh, the Missouri is just so wonderful and wide and so open for recreation, and people use it. So there's really something festive and kind of magical about being out on the water, whether you're, you know, on a boat with lots of people congregating in Minnesota Lakes country, or if you're out on a boat on the Missouri. So those are some really great options to explore. There's always great dining options to check out along the route as well.
Hidden gems, and I'm going to name states for you. Let's start with Minnesota, where you started earlier today.
Excellent. Yeah, I love Minnesota. Minnesota is my home state. But one of my favorite places is Minnesota's North Shore. That's maybe not a hidden gem as a zone, but there's all these wonderful beaches, these gorgeous pebble beaches in these sand colors of pink. And they have wonderful like black stone beaches, which are fun for skipping stones, lots of lighthouses, some of the best state parks in the region. So, I mean, yes, you can start in Duluth, and lots of people do. And that's a wonderful city. And it feels very unlike where I grew up on the prairie part of Minnesota. It feels definitely a world away. But I think going a little bit further north, kind of cruising along into some of the smaller towns, pulling over for waterfalls, that kind of thing, can feel really magical. And you always kind of feel like you're discovering these places, even though, of course, you know, they're on a scenic route, they're not unknown, but it feels so different from everyday life, which I think is really what people want from a vacation experience. So definitely the North Shore never disappoints.
All right. State two, Montana.
I love Billings and I love Bozeman in Montana. Love, love, love. But I feel like that's a little bit more, like they're not unknown and they're a little bit more of a small town / city break. So if you want great dining, you want great craft beer, you want excellent music and a really cool art scene and great used bookstores, those are wonderful. And that's really what I go to Montana for, because then any city that you go to in Montana has really excellent hiking just anywhere you go, right? So it's a given. So I think Montana's super easy that way. But I also have been going east, and that's strange because, like, I didn't go to Wisconsin all that often growing up, and Minnesota's right next to it. I don't really know why. So I'm discovering Wisconsin a little bit late in life, but better late than never. In Wisconsin, I really love Madison. Now, I know you and I did an interview back when I was in Madison.
I remember that well.
Yeah. Yeah, the food is so great. And it's one of those places that's really good for families as well. They've got an excellent Dane County Farmers Market, which goes now through November. Really fun night markets, which kind of have the energy of the street fair that we have here in Fargo-Moorhead, here in downtown Fargo, I should say. And that happens, you know, monthly, May through October. A really, really great children's museum, some excellent, really pedestrian-friendly shopping and walking, and a really scenic campus there. So I really like that as well. So I know those are a little bit more like not the lake kind of vacation that we were talking about earlier, but if you're looking for hidden gems that are a lot of fun, I really recommend all of those cities, Bozeman and Billings in Montana, and also Madison, Wisconsin.
Last state I'm going to throw at you is South Dakota. Where's a hidden gem in South Dakota?
Okay. Sioux Falls, I think here in Fargo, we tend to overlook Sioux Falls because we want the more exotic and rugged Black Hills, which makes sense. But if you're traveling, especially with a family, I think Sioux Falls is a really overlooked family-friendly destination. First of all, the dining is great. We've got lots of folks getting James Beard Award nods, lots of semifinalists in the area, so I think that's really interesting. So that's a good, like, adult-friendly thing, and good music there, too, great arts. But for kids, they have the wonderful Great Plains Zoo, Butterfly House and Aquarium, and then the Washington Pavilion, where you can literally go to a Broadway show if you want, the Planetarium. There's a Science Discovery Center with over 100 hands-on exhibits. You can get ice cream right in the building. There's art. I think we kind of overlook what we might be used to, and there's this idea that, like, especially here in Fargo-Moorhead, like, Sioux Falls is kind of culturally and emotionally similar to Fargo. So we're like, oh, we don't need to go there. That's kind of like here. But I think especially if you have a family and you want to do something a little unexpected, it can be a lot of fun.
How far in advance do people really need to worry about things like booking lodging in the region, booking campsites for places like the Black Hills or other places like that?
I would start looking now. Sooner than you think is always the recommendation, and that was the case before the pandemic. But since the pandemic, the numbers for national parks have been climbing, and state parks have been kind of absorbing a lot of that overflow, and that includes areas like campgrounds as well. People maybe that weren't campers or hikers before the pandemic realized they liked it, kind of got a little more confidence, and went out and visited. So as more trafficked national parks began to fill up, that sort of spilled over into similar destinations, you know, that are geographically nearby or places that offer similar amenities. So now the big ones, the Black Hills, Itasca State Park, and also lots of those camping spots that I mentioned on the North Shore in Minnesota, they fill up really quickly. If they're particularly scenic, they fill up fast. I wrote a book with colleagues called Midwest State Park Adventures that I'm looking at right now. And it's one of those things where it's kind of helpful to go through, like, if you have a region that you're looking at, to look at maybe your first, second, and third choice for state parks in that area and kind of book accordingly, right? And as always, if you book midweek, that helps a little bit, both for avoiding the crowds and for a little bit more availability.
What tips do you have for folks who may want to get out into the region, but they're thinking about places maybe that are a little busier, like Medora or Duluth or even Glacier National Park? Does day of the week matter? Is June better than July? Is July better than August? Or shoulder seasons should we be thinking about?
Shoulder season, you know, kind of early in the season or late always makes a difference. Just kind of be aware that there may be reduced amenities during those times. Medora, I'm glad you brought that up. Season, not as many restaurants and shops may be open, and it kind of opens up to the full season, you know, when summer gets blazing. But for lots of folks, if you're out for hiking or that kind of thing, it really doesn't matter. So earlier, late in the season is always great. Midweek does tend to make a difference, although I think the secret is kind of out. Other people are figuring that out too. But obviously, obviously a holiday week. If you're trying to book something for 4th of July, be aware that lots of places, both at, you know, big national parks and at, you know, kind of those wonderful tried and true tourist destinations, lots of people book that family vacation the minute that they leave the year before. So that's really what you're competing with. So book as early as you can. And if you can't get into, you know, your first or second choice, maybe do what the kids call dupes or duplicates. It kind of, it applies to travel as well as, like, you know, doing a duplicate of a makeup product or a bag. So find a destination that is similar in spirit and has similar amenities to the place that you really want to go that may not be available. Because the fact of the matter is, we are in the U.S. Lots of us have limited vacation time. We're lining up, especially if you're traveling with a family, maybe extracurricular activities and camps and maybe more than one person's vacation. And it gets to be a lot to work around. So I would suggest, like, if you're interested in Medora, and maybe the place you want to stay is full, what if you explored the North Unit and stayed in Watford City, right? Or if you really wanted to get out and about and explore nature and you're not wild about doing that with a bunch of other people, you can ride or walk the Mataje Trail, which kind of weaves throughout the region. Sully Creek State Park is been renamed Rough Rider State Park, and that's really just right outside of Medora, so you can get that really wild, untamed environment with many fewer people. And so the dupe thing applies to Duluth as well. So you like Duluth, right? But maybe that's a little crowded, a little too people-y for you, as my niece would say. Go a little bit further north. Just head on down the road. Two Harbors is really beautiful. Or, you know, even further along, Grand Marais, there's those smaller cities. They're less crowded. They may have more availability. Or, you know, you may find a place to stay along the route. And when you just need that little bit of solitude, you can go to some of these smaller communities. And for Glacier, which, I mean, is absolutely gorgeous and consistently popular, you have a couple options too. Some folks pointed out that North Cascades National Park in Washington State is obviously a different part of the country, but it technically has more glaciers and really similar hiking. So if that's what you're going to Glacier National Park for, there are options as well. Or if you want to stay in that geographic area, if you're like, Alicia, that's great, but I mean, we're driving and we only have a limited amount of time. If you've got passports or ID cards, you can head over the border to the sister park, Waterton Lake State Park, just across up into Canada, and get the same scenery. You know, borders are kind of just
lines on a map,
human-made creation. So
we're enjoying our conversation with Alicia Underly Nelson. She's a freelance writer who specializes in immersive travel stories, hidden history, outdoor adventures, art, street food, and beer. Budget-friendly travel ideas, Alicia, for couples or for families who want to explore the region without breaking the bank.
Absolutely. Well, we've talked a little bit about the Black Hills in South Dakota back and forth. And that is one of those options that I recommended it to friends of mine from college who live in Chicago now. And they were stunned by how much they were able to do as a, you know, a fairly large family with a multi-generational trip. They were like, wow, we could eat out every night. We could do all these activities. It's really affordable. And the nice thing about the Black Hills is it's an incredibly well-visited destination for a reason. It's incredibly beautiful. And for my money, Custer State Park competes with many national parks that I've been to in terms of wildlife, beauty, scenery, solitude. I mean, it's gorgeous, right? And then you've got, you know, Crazy Horse, the memorial there is really coming along beautifully. Mount Rushmore is one of those things that people always want to see. And all these great little towns in the hills, whether you're in the north part or the south, have their own unique character. Lots of those really charming, you know, locally owned shops and restaurants that give you a real local experience. And people love that. And it's still priced really affordably. They consistently do well with tourism. And the last time I was in the Black Hills last fall, I mean, there are people there from all over the world that were really enjoying it. So your money goes a long way there. And then I would also recommend Winnipeg is great. People don't often think about how technically close Winnipeg is. I mean, here in Fargo-Moorhead, people are often shocked when I tell them they can get to Winnipeg just as easily as they could get to Minneapolis from our front door. I literally tell people, man, from Fargo, you just get on I-29 and drive north. There you go. You stop and you get to your hotel. It's as easy as it could possibly be. And it's such a wonderful city. Shopping and food at the Forks. My favorite spa, Thermea, is in Winnipeg, so you can go hot tubbing. And it's just magical, like you're indoors, outdoors, you're getting all these amazing treatments. It's the most relaxing place in the world, world-class dining. And the Winnipeg Art Gallery has the largest collection of Inuit art in the world, contemporary Inuit art, which I think is really interesting. And it also, Winnipeg is home of one of my favorite museums on the planet, the Museum of Human Rights, which is absolutely an experience that I would recommend, even if you're not normally a museum person. So it's a budget-friendly option. And, you know, while the Black Hills is a little bit more family-oriented, nature-oriented, and Winnipeg is a much more urban experience, both give you a lot of bang for your buck.
Relative to driving routes, is the North Shore in the region maybe your favorite place to just get a favorite scenic byway and just enjoy the beauty as you're driving along? First trip we took after we moved here, when we wanted to go somewhere, that's where we went, and it was wonderful.
It's one of those places where, like, you know, sometimes there are certain parts of the country that have lots of hidden gems, and you have to work for it, right? And this area just puts it all out there for you. I went there with my husband and my son a couple years back, and it was so fun to just kind of pull over, and all these beautiful wildflowers blooming along the side of the road, these incredible little bakeries and cute little shops, these wonderful beaches. Like, we stopped in towards some lighthouses. There's great fishing and little picnic spots. You know, there's waterfalls along the way. I mean, it makes it so simple. So whether you're a person that likes to stop along the way and get out and see all those things, as I definitely do, or if you're someone that just, you know, maybe out on a motorcycle, or you want to take the convertible out and put the top down and just cruise, I mean, there's a lot to see no matter which way you approach that scenic drive. And that's really what I look for when I'm looking for a scenic route, is like, where are those stretches between destinations, especially scenic? And then when I do need to get out to stretch my legs, do I have a lot of options? And that really delivers. So I really can't recommend it enough.
Let's turn the page just a little bit and talk about international travel. You just returned.
Absolutely.
You just returned from a trip to Europe. Want to hear about that a little bit. But did anything surprise you this time around as you traveled to Europe, whether it was either culturally, logistically, maybe even politically, or even cost?
Actually, all of those things surprised me. I have traveled to Europe many times, and we were in Germany, France, and Switzerland for this particular trip. And I've been to Germany several times. In fact, Germany and Spain are the countries that I've visited the most. But a lot has changed, I would say. For practical matters, Germany used to be extremely cash-based. Now it's a little bit easier to just use a credit card. In fact, I really didn't need the cash that I took out of the ATM at all. Which, P.S., take it out of the ATM. It's a much better exchange rate. And use a credit card that doesn't have foreign transaction fees. Makes it really affordable. So that was kind of refreshing and made life a little bit easier. And then I think I definitely noticed a lot of kindness and civility, which is a little bit different. I left the United States at a really, really charged political moment. And there's rightly a lot of things being very fiercely debated and a lot of, I would say, frustration in the population in general. And it was really a breath of fresh air to go to Europe and realize how very, very long human history is, and how this type of turmoil, in a way, while it is specific and new to us in the United States, and the situation is, of course, specific, humans have been living together more or less successfully for a really long time, and Europe has a much longer view of history than the United States does. So, and I think that does show up in the way that they address each other, and the way that they talk to each other, and the way that they cooperate with each other. And just the questions they were asking me as an American were really different. And we went there to visit my cousin and his family. And we spend a lot of time when I travel talking to local people. Just, you know, you're out and about in the markets and the shops, and people are curious, and the kind of things we were talking about were different. But I'm always impressed by the kindness and the nuance that the people of Europe show. And yeah, it was a really good trip.
Anything changed recently relative to transportation between countries, whether it be in the air or on the train or even driving, that you noticed?
I think a lot of people are discussing sort of how it is to come back into the United States because of the new sort of restrictions and questions that people are asking when you cross our border. But I would say that the border crossing going into Europe was extremely smooth. And what's nice is because everything is part of the American Union or the European Union, my apologies. Americans are able to travel really freely between Germany, France, and Switzerland by train, by car. There aren't really any checks or anything that you need to worry about, which was really nice. And it gave us a lot of flexibility. And of course, everything is so close together that it's very accessible by train. I really love European trains, although we did not travel that way this time. And that was largely because of the way the restrictions we were putting on the situation. As I said, my cousin and his family have really little kids. So they're living in that time frame where, like, you have a couple hours in the morning, you know, while the kids are awake, and then a couple hours in the afternoon. So we were planning around nap time, and we just couldn't quite make all the timing work out on a short trip for nap time. So we did rent a car, which was easy and seamless. But in most cases, I wouldn't even recommend it because you don't need it. It's so easy to travel to and from each country. And because of where they were located in Germany, it was actually much cheaper and faster for us just to fly into Zurich, Switzerland, and add another country to our list and explore. And even the smaller cities, my cousin lives in a very small town. I mean, smaller than Fargo Moorhead by quite a lot. And there's really wonderful regular train service, both throughout the region and from different countries. And a lot of times people think, oh my gosh, that seems so intimidating. It seems so scary. Swiss trains, German trains, even, you know, Spanish and Portuguese and French trains that I've used are extremely reliable. They're really easy to use with an app. People will help you at the counter. There's definitely English spoken. And you don't need to necessarily do the Eurorail thing unless you're going to be traveling to multiple countries. It's really super easy to just go back and forth by train. And there's a new Flixbus that is very useful as well. And that is kind of shorter destinations or, you know, inter-country trips, which is nice and extremely affordable. There aren't as many bus options usually in Germany particularly, but there's still a lot more than we're used to here in North Dakota. So their idea of reduced service is amazing to those of us that maybe don't enjoy that kind of mass transit readily.
My guest has been Alicia Underlee-Nelson. She's a freelance writer and photographer. She specializes in immersive travel stories and visits with us periodically here on Main Street. And we are glad that she's been able to spend time with us today. Thanks, Alicia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come on Main Street, our weekly visit with the segment Our Living Lands, and also our weekly trip back to the North Dakota Legislature with our very own podcast In Session, and finally a report from Harvest Public Media. That's all ahead on Main Street. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez, and this is Our Living Lands. Four tribes in the Columbia River Basin, Pacific lamprey, are a key traditional food, but dams and climate change are threatening lamprey populations. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Kane and Moses Connor, a lamprey technician for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, about their lamprey conservation efforts.
Long before the dams, the Pacific lamprey swam these waters. Here are the sounds of Kane releasing the lamprey into the river. Here's our conversation. Can you share why lamprey are so important to the Umatilla, Cayuse, and Walla Walla people and the broader Columbia River ecosystem?
They provided a lot of calories and a lot of protein and a lot of fat during the lean times during the winter months for us. Stories I've heard was because they have 7 gill ports on the side of their body. And when we first seen that, like the people, they seen it as a sign, as it was a sacred fish. But as far as like for the ecosystem, you know, the lamprey, they are anadromous, so they go to the ocean, start in the freshwater, and go to the ocean and come back. And they provided a lot of nutrients for the river systems that they brought back from the ocean.
And with rising water temperatures and changing river flows and habitat loss, you know, like due to dams and climate change is posing, you know, serious threats to lamprey. What specific impacts have you seen, and how is this affecting tribal conservation efforts?
After they built the dams, a lot of habitat was lost because there just wasn't a lot of places for the juveniles to rear. I mean, the rising temperature, like with climate change, it just comes with, you know, not enough snow in the wintertime. So by the time summer rolls around, you know, our river's looking more lower volume of water, higher temperatures. And a big thing with that, too, is agriculture. So I think just the river being drained so much by the diversions canals for agriculture has a big impact on migrating fish at the time.
You know, the Umatilla tribe has been at the forefront of land prairie restoration. Could you break down some of the key projects that your team is working on to bring land prairie back to the Columbia River Basin?
First and foremost, it's food for us. So the main thing we want to do is bring the river systems back to natural production. So the ways we are doing that are translocation is our main one, where we go and trap lamprey from the main stem Columbia from the dams, and we trap the fish there, and then we haul them up to one of our holding facilities. We hold the fish there until springtime, until they're in spawn phase, and then we'll outplant them. And that is the biggest part of the project, because what we're doing is kind of forcing the lamprey to spawn in our rivers or the tributaries that we put them in. We also are improving passage. When the dams are first built, they were not built for lamprey whatsoever. We know before we started improving passage that lamprey at every dam, they were cut in half. So now what they're starting to do is improve the fish ladders by creating curves in the ladders instead of when they were built, it was just a bunch of, you know, 90 degree angles going up. And, you know, they were just made for salmon, basically. And we also are installing what we call LPSs, or lamprey passage systems, which is basically just like a big metal slide, which makes it easier for the lamprey to crawl over the dam. And so far, I can tell you that we are getting pretty positive results, because the release sites that we outplanted those fish at, there's actually taking hold.
You know, indigenous knowledge has always guided sustainable land and water stewardship. How does the Umatilla tribe incorporate traditional ecological knowledge into modern conservation strategies for lamprey?
When we do harvest lamprey, because we do have a harvest in lamprey in late June, early July, we don't ever take more than we need. We're not over harvesting lamprey because of, you know, the population. And so we've always just taken, you know, what we needed. And that's what we do when we go down to Willamette Falls to harvest lamprey too. You know, we don't take any more than we need for ceremonies back home, the longhouse, and for subsistence for the people.
Looking ahead, what are the biggest obstacles to lamprey recovery?
The biggest obstacles, I would say, for lamprey recovery is mostly just the lack of knowledge that the community has of lamprey. Recently, you know, we had some kindergartners come in and get to hold lamprey. You're looking at 5-6-year-olds holding a prehistoric fish, you know, for the first time. I think that's where it starts for recovery for lamprey, is just educating people and obviously dams. I've been a voice for the lamprey for 16 years now or more. And so the more voices that the lamprey have, I believe that, you know, a better chance for recovery they will have.
And how do you guys say lamprey in your tribal language?
Kasoyas.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents Beer, Brats, and Brass, featuring the brass and percussion sections performing jazz, classical, funk, and polka. Friday, May 2nd at 6 p.m. at Drecker Brahalla. Ticket information at fmsymphony.org.
Ethics. They underlie our decisions from everyday life to how we vote. They are the morals and the values by which we determine if someone else is good or bad. And in 2018, a majority of North Dakota voters decided legislators needed some of that oversight. Like, is it appropriate to introduce a bill where a policymaker had a financial interest? Or a process for complaints if someone believed a legislator was accepting gifts from lobbyists?
The North Dakota Ethics Commission is the child of that citizen ballot initiative approved by voters in 2018, but from the get-go, Bismarck controlled the purse strings. In 2019, then-Governor Doug Burgum signed a bill providing for a fine for using campaign funds for personal use. The amount? $100. And the reason we're talking about the Ethics Commission now is because of the sentencing of Ray Holmberg and how it caused Republican Representative Rios and the Young Republicans of North Dakota to draft a resolution enacting mandatory reporting requirements for public officials. If you know something, you have to say something.
Right. And the response from one of the committee members when Representative Rios went to present this resolution was, why don't you take this to the Ethics Commission? The Holmbrink sentencing also brought up a debate about how much the Ethics Commission is funded. Senator Mathern and Representative Hansen have pushed just in the last couple of weeks for doubling the budget of the Ethics Commission to put more resources into it because of the backlog of complaints, which have been 59 since January 1st.
A couple of weeks ago on the House floor during a debate about the Ethics Commission's budget, Representative Mike Nathy spoke up in favor of an amendment that would address that backlog by requiring the commission to dismiss complaints after 180 days.
It's being weaponized just for the accusation. Some of these complaints are quite frivolous, to be honest with you, but they sit there and they know they can make a complaint against somebody and use it. But yet the accused can't say anything. So we put this in here to at least give the opportunity to the accused to answer it publicly. We talked to the Attorney General. He said, according to the initiated measure, according to the Constitution, that executive director would have the authority to move these along. So, Mr. Speaker, your committee said, you know what? We're going to give you a tool. We're going to help you move this along and have it at 180 days.
How to structure the Ethics Commission, set its fines, establish requirements for addressing its backlog, determine how much money it gets and for what, is a set of ethical questions in themselves.
So we wanted to unpack the Ethics Commission, and who better to do that than a philosophy professor? For this week's episode of In Session, I took a moment to chat with Jack Russell Weinstein, who hosts his own nationally popular podcast, Why? The Ethics Commission was born out of a citizen-generated grassroots effort. It passed 53% to 46%. As Measure 1 in 2018. The following year, the House Bill 1521 that Governor Burgum signed, it put the fine for using campaign finances for personal purposes, and I think this is the compliance piece, that sort of that shady, that gray area between, you know, doing a good thing, so putting a fine on bad behavior, but he put the fine at $100. That's what he signed into law.
It strains the imagination to think that people didn't, at minimum, have a sense of what was going on with Holmberg. And there were probably people who knew some of the details. And so you have this question, am I my brother's keeper? Are we responsible for the morality of others? And so what the Ethics Commission is trying to say is yes. Yes, we are. We have a responsibility. If we know things and we don't act on them, we are participating in a certain way. And in order for that to be meaningful, there has to be consequences. They have to be able to act on the tips. North Dakota University System has an anonymous tip line. If you think people are embezzling or misusing resources, you can call this anonymous tip line. And so the idea is you want to encourage people to report what they know. But then the Ethics Commission is taking the next step, which is saying, not only do we want you to report what you know, we're holding you responsible for what you know. And to respond to that by saying the fine is $100 is a way of finding a loophole, getting around it. It's a way of giving a wink and a nod, and it's a way of giving a pass by saying, okay, the people wanted this Ethics Commission, and we like to say that we are sharing in joint responsibility for everyone's ethics, but we all know that's not true, and we're all going to let these things slide. That's at least how it seems to be.
No, I caught up the other day with one of your former students, Dane DeCray, who's a defense attorney, and we had, and I guess you almost convinced him to change his major to philosophy because he was so enamored of your class and your.
I remember Dane well. I remember.
How
Dane
could you
well.
Not remember yeah. Dane well? He's a very special spirit. But what he likened it to a, the luxury tax, you know, the penalty that the Yankees pay to get the better players. It's walking around money for them.
I think that's a that's actually a really apt and useful analogy, because when you are rich enough, the rules don't matter. So Jeff Bezos famously has a hedge which is much too high for the property zoning that he lives in. He doesn't care. He just pays the fine every month, right? He's not going to cut down the hedges. And so the other thing that this does is it gives power to the people who aren't sacrificing themselves for the legislature. I mean, this is a citizen legislature. So there are people who go who are very, very financially comfortable, who going for this long period of time in Bismarck doesn't interfere with their lives too much or their income. And then there are people who are just barely making it and who every dollar counts and who are really committed to this process despite the sacrifice because it's really important to them. And with this $100 fine, it divides the legislature into two categories: the people who are wealthy enough not to care, and the people who aren't wealthy enough who are burdened by a fine like this. And the wealthier legislators are going to be the people who have been in the legislature longer, who have established themselves through age and through reputation and through professional behavior more than the newer legislatures. So additionally, what this does is create a divide that says, if you've been around for a long time, like Ray Holmberg and his contemporaries, you're not responsible for telling people. We don't want our deep secrets told.
I wanted to compare this with law enforcement or how public information is shared, because the Ethics Commission leans a lot on confidentiality. The commission, I'm quoting directly from the website here, the commission cannot confirm or deny whether a complaint exists against a particular respondent. And I compare that with if you are charged with a crime, like I can go to the local police precinct right now and I can get a list of names of all the people who have been charged with crimes. And that's public information. You know, that's why we see it on local commercial TV news. They got the mugshots and everything. It just struck me that there are two standards about what the bar is for public information. You know, if you're charged with a crime, that is public information. The Ethics Commission does not appear to have that standard.
One of the questions is, does it hurt people to be accused of a crime but not having been found guilty, right? We are in a system that purports to have the belief that people are innocent until proven guilty. But we also know that there are certain accusations that when people make, they're believed, and even when they're disproven, they follow you like a shadow. And so does it make sense for us to report accusations before they're confirmed? And so what we have here again is two different standards. The political figures in the legislature are protecting their reputation. And I understand why, right? They're before the electorate. They want to get votes. But they are public figures. And in terms of freedom of speech, in terms of freedom of information, public figures usually have a lot more leeway and usually find out a lot more about them than private citizens. Additionally, legislators have a lot of power. They have power to manipulate the system. They understand how it works very well. Journalists owe them favors. Private citizens don't have that power. Private citizens can't manipulate the media. Private citizens often don't have access to good lawyers or good PR people or anything like that. And so it actually seems like it should be the reverse. It seems like politicians should be exposed when the accusations are first announced, because then the electorate can meditate on the accusation before they vote. And private citizens, that information should not be announced because they don't have the ability to protect themselves from the publicity. And so while on the one hand, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that the Ethics Commission remains anonymous, people deserve to be free from accusations without evidence, accusations without due process, I'm also skeptical of it, because it once again feels like a way of cutting the teeth of the legislation, of making the Ethics Commission less powerful, less meaningful, and therefore less effective.
Thanks, Jack. It's been great.
Good. I hope it's helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Jack Russell Weinstein and Ann Ahlquist in conversation. Jack is a philosophy professor from the University of North Dakota, a cool one at that, and the host of Why, a very popular podcast. And since you were in the room with Jack there, what was your takeaway from that conversation? Always fun to talk to Jack.
Well, I'm going to take a play out of Jack's playbook, which is whenever I asked him a question, he would come back at me with, well, let's unpack the question that you're asking here. And then he would ask it in a different way. I just have more questions. Like, where does power come from? How do people hold on to it? How did Senator Holmberg hold on to his power for that long, for all those
decades? Yeah.
And then where does collective power come from and gain momentum? Because the ballot initiative came from a group of residents and citizens in North Dakota over years. They organized over years because they said, we need some accountability. So in the spirit of asking more questions, and April is Poetry Month, mm-hmm. I turned to someone who loved questions, which was the Austrian poet from the 19th century, Rainer Maria Rilke. This is what he said. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. And I hope that we all live long enough to live into the answers of these mighty deep questions about the Ethics Commission.
That's the beauty of philosophy, isn't it, right? It's leading us down a path. It's a breadcrumb trail to get to the truth and the answers we're all seeking. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode of In Session. Tate Calloway is our radio studio operator. Christine McClellan is our communications manager. And Leah Peterson is our digital communications specialist. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Ann Ahlquist. We'll see you next week.
Support for PrayPublic is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, dedicated to producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind projects in North and South Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. American farmers are grappling with low crop prices, rising input costs, and the renewed U.S.-China trade war, which has slashed exports and driven up equipment prices due to tariffs. While some fear a farming crisis similar to the 1980s, many still back President Trump, hoping his trade policies will ultimately benefit agriculture, despite their blunt execution, as we hear in this report from Harvest Public Media.
On Glen Broncos, farm in the Kansas Flint Hills, it's about time to shear sheep and plant soybeans. Broncos livestock are lucrative this year, but the long hours they'll put in growing corn and soybeans are likely to cost him money.
This is a pretty tough time, to be honest. This is about as grim a time as I've seen for crop production. Nothing looks like it's going to make money right now.
Mainly because everything that Bronco has to buy to stay in business has gone through the roof. But crop prices are low. Lots of farmers are operating in the red. Bronco supports President Trump, but says his trade war is going to hurt.
But yeah, we're already stressed, and this doesn't help.
Until recently, China was buying about a quarter of the U.S. soy crop. But then Trump slapped 145% tax on Chinese imports. China struck back with 135% tariff on U.S. soybeans, closing off Bronco's biggest export market. Meantime, Trump's broad import taxes are turbocharging inflation on farm equipment.
It means we hold on to stuff, we fix things instead of trading them off, and just make do with what we have.
They're feeling that a few miles away at the Can Equip dealership in Wamego, Kansas. Parts program manager Doug Meinhardt says most of the tractors on his lot are imported.
All the small tractors are made overseas. The medium-sized tractors are made you know, in Europe, all the smaller ones are made over in Asia, and that's all going to have tariffs on it.
The biggest and most sophisticated farm tractors are built in the U.S., generally with now highly taxed imported steel. Meinhardt says the 1980s farm crisis triggered the shakeout in the tractor industry, consolidating production under a handful of global corporations that divvied it up across three continents. Back then, sky-high operating costs and low crop prices, sound familiar, drove thousands of U.S. farmers under.
I mean, a lot of equipment manufacturers and dealers went out of business in the 80s, too, and it could happen again.
A sense of foreboding is spreading across farm country this spring.
There's a whole bunch of things that are happening at the same time, and none of them are good.
Vance Emke and Louise Emke, married 53 years, formed ground in western Kansas that his ancestors homesteaded in 1885. They feel like Trump is hanging them out to dry.
If you make it, fine. If you don't, so what? And down the road, he thinks the survivors will be fine. Well, what about the rest of us? Where's the graveyard for that?
Trump says farmers should get ready to sell a lot more food inside the United States. Emke says that's not so easy.
Annually, here in Kansas, we grow, say, 400 million bushels of wheat. Half of that has got to be exported, period. I cannot eat two loaves of bread a day. It won't work. We got to export that.
U.S. farmers have spent decades carefully nurturing lucrative trade relationships with foreign buyers. Emke says Trump's fast-shifting tariffs are telling good customers, China, Canada, Mexico, for instance, to shop elsewhere. It's got Louise on edge. She keeps the books for this 14,000-acre farm and seed business and says it's hard to plan.
Oh, it's no man's land or no woman's land. I mean, either way, whatever, where are we going and where are we going to end up is this is a concern. You know, I think we hope we land with our both feet on the ground, but it's sure feeling like we're floating and cannot make decisions.
Last time he was in office, Trump dipped into the Treasury, spending $23 billion to compensate farmers for the damage caused by a much smaller trade war. Trump has pledged more of the same this time around, but many farmers say they'd rather depend on their own hard work and open markets than on another bailout from the Trump administration. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Frank Morris.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 22nd. Childhood in North Dakota has always been a roller coaster of events, with a surprising number of stories relying on luck for their happy endings. On this date in 1911, the Bismarck Tribune reported an incident involving a 4-year-old boy in Jamestown. The child, Johnny, was playing with other small boys when he slipped and fell into an abandoned well. A passerby saw Johnny and rushed to help, managing to pull him out. Despite falling around 20 feet, Johnny was uninjured, aside from some cuts and bruises. Several years later, in Minot, 8-year-old Kenneth Nolf was riding a toboggan when it was struck by a grocery store delivery wagon. Though not fatally injured, Kenneth suffered several painful bruises after being thrown from the toboggan on impact. In a separate incident in Plaza, North Dakota, in 1921, 7-year-old Frances Hagen was hurt while helping her father with a cream separator. Mr. Hagen reported that the separator blew up as they were using it for the first time. Frances, who was holding the machine, was cut badly when the cap flew off the bowl and parts of the separator flew across the room. At the hospital, doctors confirmed a lacerated tendon in her knuckle, but assured the family that she would heal well and be as good as new. And finally, a hunting accident from 1915. While out bird hunting with his son, L.H. Smith loaded a second shell into his gun, believing he had dropped the first one. When he pulled the trigger, the extra shell caused the barrel to explode just above the handhold. Smith was injured by the blast when a piece of steel scratched and bruised his arm and hand. His son, luckily, was standing on the opposite side of the gun and escaped unharmed. A local doctor dressed the wounds, and Smith was expected to make a full recovery, though he was fortunate not to lose his hand. they surely made memories and had adventures they'd retell to their own children in the years to come. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Olivia Burmeister. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for this Tuesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tomorrow on the show, let's get ready for Fargo's flattest, friendliest race. And of course, we're talking about the Essentia Health Fargo Marathon. Plus, we'll have Coffee King Dex Dutton. He'll brew up stories of beans and community on Prairie Plates. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.
Tonight's forecast, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-20s to mid-30s.